It may be politically incorrect to note these kinds of gender differences, but they are obvious to aid workers and national leaders alike. Botswana has been one of the fastest-growing countries in the world for decades, and its former president, Festus Mauhai, was widely regarded as one of Africa's most able leaders. He laughed when we suggested delicately that women in Africa typically work harder and handled money more wisely than men, and he responded, "You couldn't be more right. Women do work better. Banks were the first to see that and hired more women, and now everybody does. In homes, too, women manage affairs better than men. In the Botswanan civil service, women are taking over. Half of the government sector is now women. The governor of the central bank, the attorney general, the chief of protocol, the director of public prosecution, they are all women. Women perform better in Africa, much better. We see that in Botswana. And their profiles are different. Deferred consumption is higher among girls, and they buy durables and have higher savings rates. Men are more consumption-oriented." Some development experts hope to see more women enter politics and government, with the idea that they can do for their countries what they do for a household. 81 countries have set aside certain positions for women, typically a share of seats in parliament to boost their political participation. 11 countries now have women as top leaders, and women hold 16% of national legislative seats around the world, up from 9% in 1987. A former member of the U.S. Congress, Marjorie Margolies Mezvinsky, has led a promising effort to get more women in governments around the world. In 1993, Margolies Mezvinsky was a newly elected Democrat in the House of Representatives when the Clinton budget, complete with tax increases to balance the accounts, came before the chamber. In retrospect, that budget is often seen as a landmark that put America on a solid fiscal footing for the 1990s, but it was ferociously controversial at the time. As a newly elected member, Margolies Mezvinsky was vulnerable, and Republicans vowed to defeat her if she voted for the tax increases. Yet in the end, she cast the deciding vote for the Clinton budget. A year later, she was indeed defeated by a slim margin. Her career as a politician was over. Now Margolies Mezvinsky runs Women's Campaign International, which coaches women grassroots activists on how to get attention for their causes, run for office, and put together coalitions to achieve their goals. In Ethiopia, where Women's Campaign International trained women to run effective campaigns, the proportion of women in parliament rose from 8% to 21%. One rationale for seeking more female politicians is that women supposedly excel in empathy and forging consensus, and thus may make, on average, more peaceful and conciliatory leaders than men. Yet we don't see much sign that women presidents or prime ministers have performed better or more peacefully than men in modern times. Indeed, women leaders haven't even been particularly attentive to issues like maternal mortality, girls' education, or sex trafficking. One reason may be that when women rise to the top of poor countries, think of Indira Gandhi, Benazir Bhutto, Corazon Aquino, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, they are almost always from elite families and have never directly encountered the abuses that poor women suffer. On the other hand, the conventional wisdom in development circles is that women office holders do make a difference at the local level, as mayors or school board members, where they often seem more attentive to the needs of women and children. One fascinating experiment took place in India after 1993, when the Indian constitution was amended to stipulate that 1/3 of the positions of village chief were to be reserved for women. These were allocated randomly, so it became possible to compare whether villages run by women were governed differently from those ruled by men. Indeed, spending priorities were different. In villages run by women, more water pumps or taps were installed, and these were also better maintained. This may be because fetching water is women's work in India, but other public services were also judged to be at least as good as in men-run villages. The researchers could find no sign that other kinds of infrastructure were being neglected. Local people reported that they were significantly less likely to have to pay a bribe in the villages run by women. Nevertheless, both male and female villagers declared themselves less satisfied with women leaders. The scholars conducting the study were puzzled by this. Services appeared to be superior, yet dissatisfaction was greater. It wasn't just male chauvinists who were upset. Women villagers were also more dissatisfied. It seemed that ordinary citizens were discomfited by women leaders forced upon them, or resented the fact that the women leaders were less educated and experienced on average than male leaders. This does suggest that women politicians, at least in India, face a hurdle. Even if they do better than men at providing services, they initially are judged more harshly. Follow-up research did find that after a village had once had a female leader, this bias against women's chiefs disappeared. Women leaders were then judged by gender-neutral standards. Such research suggests that quotas for local female leaders may be worthwhile because they overcome the initial hurdle that blocks women candidates. An Indian-style quota of women office holders seems to break down gender barriers so that afterward the political system becomes more democratic and open. Whatever the impact of women as leaders, we have some direct evidence from America's own history of the broad consequences of female political participation. As we noted earlier, maternal mortality in the United States declined significantly only once women gained the right to vote. When women had a political voice, their lives also became a higher priority. In addition, there is strong evidence that when women gained the vote, the political system responded by allocating more funds to public health programs, particularly for child health, because this was an issue that women voters were perceived as caring about strongly. Grant Miller, a scholar at Stanford University, has conducted a brilliant study of the health response when, state by state, women obtain the right to vote. He found that when women gained the vote, the politicians in that state scrambled to win favor from women voters by allocating more funds to child health care. This did not happen in states where women remained unable to vote. Within a year of suffrage law enactment, patterns of legislative roll call voting shifted, and local public health spending rose by roughly 35%, Professor Miller wrote. Child mortality declined by 8 to 15% with the enactment of suffrage laws. Nationwide, these reductions translate into roughly 20,000 averted child deaths each year. The same thing happened at a national level. A year after the 19th Amendment gave women all across the country the right to vote in 1920, Congress passed the Sheppard-Towner Act, a landmark program for public health. The principal force moving Congress was fear of being punished at the polls by the new women voters, one historian wrote. The improvement in America's health during this period was stunning. The mortality rate for children aged 1 to 4 plummeted 72% between 1900 and 1930, although there are many other reasons for this decline as well, of course. As Professor Miller notes, opponents of women's political participation have often made the argument that if women get involved in outside activities, then children will suffer. In fact, the evidence from our own history is that women's political participation has proved to be a vast, life-saving benefit to America's children. A care package for Goretti. The lush landscape of northern Burundi constitutes one of the loveliest spots in Africa, with jutting hills looming over dark green fields and coffee trees swaying in the breezes. The climate is more pleasant here than in the lowlands, and the mud-walled huts are sparse. Yet this picturesque land is home to some of the most impoverished people on the planet, and one of the most forlorn of these was Goretti Nyabenda. Goretti was largely a prisoner in her hut, which was made of red adobe clay. Women here are supposed to get their husband's permission each time they leave the property, and her husband, a grouchy man named Bernard, didn't like to give it. Goretti was 35 years old and a mother of six. but she wasn't even allowed to go to the market by herself. Bernard and Goretti grew bananas, cassava, potatoes, and beans on a depleted half-acre plot, but they barely earned enough to survive. They were too poor to afford mosquito nets for all the children, even though malaria kills many people in the area. Bernard typically goes 3 times a week to a bar to drink homemade banana beer, spending $2 a session. His trips to the bar cost the family 30% of its disposable income. Goretti, who had never been to school, was not permitted to buy anything or to deal with cash at all. In her entire life, she had never touched even a 100-franc note, worth less than 10 American cents. She and Bernard would walk together to the market to shop, and he would hand over the money to the seller, and then she would carry the goods home. Goretti's interactions with Bernard consisted mostly of being beaten, interspersed with having sex. When we talked, she sat on a grass mat behind her hut. It was a sunny day, but the air was pleasantly cool and refreshing, and a chorus of insects serenaded her. Goretti was wearing a brown knit shirt. Some American had donated it to charity and it had migrated to Central Africa, over a colorful yellow wraparound skirt. She keeps her hair close cropped, almost in a crew cut, because it is easier to manage that way, and she frowned as she described her mood. I was wretched, because I always stayed in the house. I didn't know other people, and I was all on my own. My husband said a wife's job is to cook, stay in the house, or work in the fields. I lived that way, so I was frustrated and angry. Then Goretti's mother-in-law told her about a program started in the village by CARE, the venerable American aid organization that is focused increasingly on the needs of women and girls. Eagerly, Goretti asked Bernard if she could go to one of the CARE meetings in the village. No, Bernard said. Goretti sulkily stayed home. Then her grandmother began telling her how wonderful CARE was, reviving her longing to participate. Goretti pleaded with Bernard, and he continued to refuse. Then, one day, Goretti went without his permission. Bernard was initially furious, but Goretti had been careful to prepare dinner early and to attend to his every need. CARE's program operates with associations of about 20 women each. So, with her grandmother and other women anxious to get involved, Goretti formed a new CARE association. The members promptly elected Goretti as their president. Often the members worked together, cultivating one family's field one day and another's the next time. So the 20 women all came to Goretti's fields and tilled her entire parcel of land in one day. When my husband saw this, he was very happy, Goretti said slyly. He said, "This group is really good," so he let me continue. Each woman brings the equivalent of a dime to each meeting. The money is pooled and loaned to one of the members, who must invest it in a money-making effort and then repay the sum with interest. In effect, the women create their own bank. Goretti borrowed $2, which she used to buy fertilizer for her garden. That was the first time she handled money. The fertilizer produced an excellent crop of potatoes that Goretti was able to sell over several days in the market for $7.50. So after just 3 months, Goretti paid off her loan, $2.30 including interest, and the capital was then loaned to another woman. Flush with cash from her potatoes, Goretti used $4.20 of the remaining profit to buy bananas to make banana beer, which sold very well in the market. That led her to launch a small business making and selling banana beer. When it was her turn to borrow again, Goretti took out another $2 loan to expand her beer business, and then she used the profits to buy a pregnant goat. The goat had its kid a month later. So Goretti now has 2 goats, as well as her beer business. At night, she brings the goats into the hut so that no one can steal them. Bernard looks longingly at Goretti's jars of banana beer, but she insists that he must not touch it. It is for sale, not consumption. Since Goretti is making money for the household, he grudgingly restrains himself. Her status rose when Bernard caught malaria and needed to be hospitalized. Goretti used the money she earned from selling beer, along with a loan from her care association, to pay the bill. "Now Bernard doesn't bother me," Goretti says. "He sees that I can do things, so he asks my opinions. He sees that I can contribute." The association members also use their meetings to trade tips on how to manipulate husbands, as well as to learn how to raise animals, to resolve family conflicts, and to start businesses. Visiting nurses provide health education, teaching the women when to take children for vaccinations, how to detect STDs, and how to avoid HIV. The women were also given the chance to take HIV tests, and Goretti tested negative. "Before, some of the women here were sick with STDs, but they didn't know it," Goretti says. "Now they have been cured. I got injections for family planning, and if I'd known about this earlier, I wouldn't have had 6 kids, maybe just 3. But if I hadn't been in the group at all, I would have wanted 10 kids." The care meetings are also teaching women to go to a hospital to give birth, and then to register the babies so that they have legal IDs. A vast challenge for girls in many countries is that they never get birth certificates or other legal documents, and so in official eyes they don't exist and aren't eligible for government assistance. There is a growing recognition in the aid community that a system of national ID cards, difficult to counterfeit, would help protect girls from being trafficked and would make it easier for them to get health services. More fundamentally, women in the care program learn that appropriate behavior for a female doesn't consist of hanging back, that they can contribute at meetings and take firm positions. "This was a culture where women couldn't speak," Goretti said. "There was an expression, 'A hen cannot speak in front of a rooster,' but now we can speak up. We're part of the community." Many of the women, including Goretti, are also attending special literacy classes through CARE. She painstakingly wrote her name for us to show that she could. The men here in northern Burundi tend to focus their efforts on the big local cash crop, coffee, either growing it themselves or working as paid laborers on the plantations. At the end of the harvest, flush with cash, many men traditionally use the money to take what is called a second wife, a mistress, often just a teenager, who stays until the money runs out. The second wives are paid in clothing and jewelry, and they are a big drain on household income, as well as an avenue for the spread of AIDS. Now, however, the women in the care program are trying to eradicate this tradition. If the husband of any woman in the association tries to take on a second wife, the other wives band together in a vigilante group and drive the mistress away. Sometimes they then go to the husband and announce that they are fining him $10. If they sound authoritative enough, he sometimes pays up, and the money goes into the association's coffers. In a sign of how much times have changed, Bernard now goes to Goretti to ask for cash. "I don't always give it to him, because we need to save," she said. "But sometimes I give him some. He allowed me to join the group, and that gave me joy. So I want him to have the chance to have fun as well." And Goretti has stopped asking permission every time she leaves the house. "I do tell him when I'm going out," she explained, "but I inform him. I don't ask." Goretti is planning further expansion of her business. She wants to breed goats for sale while continuing to peddle her beer. Plenty can still go wrong. Bernard may get jealous and take it out on her. Wild animals could kill her goats. A drought could destroy her crops and leave her with debts. Continued instability in Burundi could lead armed groups to pillage her crops. And all the beer she is making may simply turn more local men into drunkards. This rural microfinance model can help families, but there are limits. Yet so far, so good. And the program is a bargain. CARE pays out less than $100 per woman over the 3-year life of the project. After that, Goretti graduates, and the project begins in a new area. That means it costs a donor 65 cents a week to help Goretti. It improves life for her, but it also means that Burundi now has another person contributing to GNP. Likewise, Goretti's children now have money for pens and notebooks to further their education, as well as a model of what a woman can become. "She has changed," said Paskasi, Goretti's eldest child, a sixth-grade girl. "Now, if Dad isn't home, she can go to the market and buy us something that we need." As for Bernard, he was a bit reluctant to be interviewed, perhaps realizing that he was being cast for the least flattering role in the family drama. But after a bit of casual chatter about banana prices, he acknowledged that he was happier with a partner than he had been with a servant. "I see my wife making money now and bringing cash into the house," he said. "I have more respect for her now." It's possible that Bernard was just telling us what we wanted to hear, but Goretti is gaining a reputation as a husband tamer, so she is in increasing demand. "Now if there's a conflict in the neighborhood, I'm asked to help," Goretti said proudly. She added that she wanted to become even more active in community projects and attend more village meetings. Bernard was listening and looked horrified, but Goretti wasn't fazed. "Before, I underestimated myself," Goretti said. "I wouldn't say anything to anybody. Now I know I have good ideas, and I tell people what I think." Chapter 12, The Axis of Equality. A woman has so many parts to her body. Life is very hard indeed. Lu Xun, Anxious Thoughts on Natural Breasts, 1927. We've been chronicling the world of impoverished women, but let's break for a billionaire. Cheng Yin is a petite, ebullient Chinese woman who started her career as a garment worker, earning $6 a month to help support her 7 siblings. Then, in the early 1980s, she moved to the special economic zone of Shenzhen and found a job at a paper trading company partly owned by foreigners. Cheng Yin learned the intricacies of the paper business, and she could have stayed and risen in the firm. But she is a relentless, ambitious woman buzzing with entrepreneurial energy, so she struck out for Hong Kong in 1985 to work for a trading company there. The company went bankrupt within a year. Cheng Yin then started her own company in Hong Kong, buying scrap paper there and shipping it to firms throughout China. She soon realized that the grand arbitrage opportunity was between waste paper in the United States and in China. Since China has few forests, much of its paper is made from straw or bamboo and is of execrable quality. That made recyclable American scrap paper, derived from wood pulp and worth very little locally, a valuable commodity in China, particularly as industrialization led to soaring demand for paper. Working with her husband, a Taiwanese, Cheng Ying at first bought American scrap paper through intermediaries, but in 1990, she moved to Los Angeles and began to work out of her home. She drove around California in a used Dodge minivan, visiting garbage dumps and making arrangements to obtain their scrap paper. The dumps were happy to make deals with her. "I had to learn from scratch," Cheng Ying said. "The business was just my husband and me, and I didn't speak a word of English." She was able to ship scrap paper back to China cheaply, because ships were bringing toys and clothing from China to California ports, but returning mostly empty. As Chinese demand for paper soared, Cheng Yin built up her company, and in 1995, she returned to China to open a papermaking plant in the southern boomtown of Dongguan. Her plants make container board, which is used to make corrugated cardboard boxes for Chinese exports. And then those boxes are trashed, recycled, and shipped, with scrap paper, through Cheng Yin's companies back to her plants in China, earning her a cut in every direction. As a result, Cheng Yin's recycling company in California, called America Cheng Nam, is now the biggest American exporter to China by volume. Her Chinese paper manufacturer, Nine Dragons Paper, has more than 5,000 employees, and she has grand ambitions for it. "My goal is to make Nine Dragons, in 3 to 5 years, the leader in container boards," she told our New York Times friend David Barboza. "My desire has always been to be the leader in an industry." By 2006, Chengyin had a net worth of $4.6 billion and topped some lists of China's richest people. Other reckonings had her a bit lower, but she was arguably the world's richest self-made woman. The Economist published an article comparing her to Andrew Carnegie, and by the reckoning of the Huron Report, which tries to track China's wealth, 6 of the 10 richest self-made women in the world are now Chinese. All this reflects the way China has established a more equal playing field for women. In a larger sense, China has emerged as a model on gender issues for developing countries. It evolved from repressing women to emancipating them, underscoring that cultural barriers can be overcome relatively swiftly where there is the political will to do so. A broad range of countries around the world, Rwanda, Botswana, Tunisia, Morocco, Sri Lanka, have likewise made rapid progress in empowering women. Challenges remain, but these countries remind us that gender barriers can be dismantled to the benefit of men and women alike. We sometimes hear people voice doubts about opposition to sex trafficking, genital cutting, or honor killings because of their supposed inevitability. What can our good intentions achieve against thousands of years of tradition? One response is China. A century ago, China was arguably the worst place in the world to be born female. Foot binding, child marriage, concubinage, and female infanticide were embedded in traditional Chinese culture. Rural Chinese girls in the early 20th century sometimes didn't even get real names, just the equivalent of number two sister or number four sister. Or perhaps even less dignified, girls might be named Lai Di or Ying Di or Zhao Di, all variations of bring a younger brother. Girls were rarely educated, often sold, and vast numbers ended up in the brothels of Shanghai. So was it cultural imperialism for Westerners to criticize foot binding and female infanticide? Perhaps. But it was also the right thing to do. If we believe firmly in certain values, such as the equality of all human beings, regardless of color or gender, then we should not be afraid to stand up for them. It would be feckless to defer to slavery, torture, foot binding, honor killings, or genital cutting just because we believe in respecting other faiths or cultures. One lesson of China is that we need not accept that discrimination is an intractable element of any society. If culture were immutable, China would still be impoverished, and Cheryl would be stumbling along on 3-inch feet. The battle for women's rights in China was as bitter as it is today in the Middle East, and there were setbacks. Chinese social conservatives were furious when young women began to cut their hair, saying that this made women look like men. In the late 1920s, street thugs would sometimes seize a woman with short hair and pull out all of her hair or even cut off her breasts. "If you want to look like a man," they said, "this will do it." Communism, after the 1949 revolution, was brutal in China, leading to tens of millions of deaths by famine or repression. But its single most positive legacy was the emancipation of women. After taking power, Mao brought women into the workforce and the Central Committee of the Communist Party, and he used his political capital to abolish child marriage, prostitution, and concubinage. It was Mao who proclaimed, "Women hold up half the sky." There were some setbacks for women with the death of ideology and the rise of a market economy in the 1980s, and Chinese women still face challenges. Even college-educated women experience discrimination in finding jobs, and sexual harassment is widespread. A Chinese cabinet minister once mistook Cheryl for a local secretary and tried to force himself on her. She got her revenge when she wrote about the incident in our book, China Wakes. Concubinage has returned with Er Nai, or number two wives, a and China has millions of prostitutes again, although in contrast to India, they mostly enter the business by choice. The combination of the one-child birth control policy and convenient access to ultrasound testing means that parents routinely check the sex of a fetus and get an abortion if it is female. The sex ratio of newborns is 116 boys for every 100 girls, meaning that many poor men will never be able to marry. This will be a source of future instability. Sadly, neither economic development nor the rise of education and a middle class seems to have affected the predilection for aborting female fetuses. All that said, no country has made as much progress in improving the status of women as China has. Over the past 100 years, it has become, at least in the cities, one of the best places to grow up female. Urban Chinese men typically involve themselves more in household tasks like cooking and childcare than most American men do. Indeed, Chinese women often dominate household decision-making, leading to the expression qi guan yan, or the wife rules strictly. And while job discrimination against women is real, it has less to do with sexism than with employers being wary of China's generous maternity benefits. We could see the progress in Cheryl's ancestral village in southern China. When Cheryl's maternal grandmother was 5 years old, her mother tried to make her beautiful by wrapping cloth bandages around her feet from her toes to her heels, starting a process that would crush the tiny bones so that she could display dainty 3-inch feet called golden lotuses. These were considered sensual. 19th century Chinese had far more erotic words for women's feet than for their breasts. Cheryl's grandmother stripped off the bandages after she moved with her husband to Toronto, but it was too late. She became the matriarch of 7 strong-willed children, but hobbled until the end of her life in tiny shoes, walking like a slim penguin on short stilts. By the time we began visiting China, foot binding had disappeared, but village women still mostly accepted second-class citizenship, pleading with the goddess of mercy for a son, and sometimes drowning their own daughters after birth. Yet the spread of education and job opportunities for young women led to a rapid recalibration of perceptions concerning gender. Educating and empowering girls is certainly the right thing to do. But, most important in the eyes of many families, it was profitable. China has enjoyed a virtuous circle in which, once girls had economic value, parents invested more in them and gave them greater autonomy. Chinese women are also making inroads in fields that were once overwhelmingly male. A majority of math or chemistry students in China are still male, but the edge is slimmer than in the United States. Chess is one of the most male-dominated pursuits all around the world, and that is also true in China. But women there are catching up more than elsewhere. In 1991, Chai Jun became the first women's world chess champion from China. And since then, two other Chinese women, Xu Chen and Shi Yuhua, have succeeded her. Moreover, a girl named Ho Yifan may be the greatest talent ever in women's chess. At the age of 14 in 2008, she narrowly lost in the finals for the Women's World Championship, and she is still improving rapidly. If any female now playing is to wrest the title of world chess champion from men, it is likely to be her. China is an important model because it was precisely its emancipation of girls that preceded and enabled its economic takeoff. The same is true of other rapidly growing Asian economies. As Homi Karas, an economist who has worked on these issues for the World Bank and the Brookings Institution, advised us, engineering an economic takeoff is really about using a nation's resources most efficiently. Many East Asian economies enjoyed a sustained boom by moving young peasant women from farms to factories after giving them a basic education for free. In Malaysia, Thailand, and China, export-oriented industries like garments and semiconductors predominantly employed young women who had previously been working in less productive family farms or doing household work. The economies got multiple benefits from this transition. By improving the labor productivity of the young women, growth was raised, By employing them in export industries, the countries got foreign exchange, which could be used to buy needed capital equipment. The young women saved much of their money or sent it back to relatives in the village, raising national saving rates. Because they had good jobs and income-earning opportunities, they also delayed marriage and childbearing, lowering fertility and population growth rates. So a major factor in East Asia's economic success was the contribution of its young peasant female workforce. It's no accident that the countries that have enjoyed an economic takeoff have been those that educated girls and then gave them the autonomy to move to the cities to find work. In contrast, it would be difficult to imagine, at least for the moment, millions of rural Pakistani or Egyptian teenage girls being fully educated and then allowed to move to the cities, while still single, to take up jobs and power an industrial revolution. Leading Indian business executives have noted that one of their country's weaknesses is that it does not employ women as efficiently as China, and they are trying to rectify that. Uzim Primji, chairman of Wipro Technologies, a leading technology company, notes that 26% of Wipro's engineers are now female. His foundation, the Azim Primji Foundation, focuses on getting more village girls in school, partly to help those individuals, but also because the result will be lower fertility and a more capable labor force to power the economy as a whole. Implicit in what we're saying about China is something that sounds shocking to many Americans. Sweatshops have given women a boost. Americans mostly hear about the iniquities of garment factories, and they are real. The forced overtime, the sexual harassment, the dangerous conditions. Yet women and girls still stream to such factories because they're preferable to the alternative of hoeing fields all day back in a village. In most poor countries, women don't have many job options. In agriculture, for example, women typically aren't as strong as men and thus are paid less. Yet in the manufacturing world, it's the opposite. The factories prefer young women, perhaps because they're more docile and perhaps because their small fingers are more nimble for assembly or sewing. So the rise of manufacturing has generally raised the opportunities and status of women. The implication is that instead of denouncing sweatshops, we in the West should be encouraging manufacturing in poor countries, particularly in Africa and the Muslim world. There is virtually no manufacturing for export in Africa, aside from Mauritius and small amounts in Lesotho and Namibia. And one of the ways we could help women in Egypt and Ethiopia would be to encourage factories for the export of cheap shoes or shirts. Labor-intensive factories would create large numbers of jobs for women, and they would bring in more capital and gender equality. The United States has established a terrific program to promote African exports by reducing tariffs on them. It's called the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, and it's an effective aid program that never gets adequate attention or support. If Western countries wanted to do something simple that would benefit African women, they would merge AGOA with the European equivalent called Everything But Arms. As the Oxford University economist Paul Collier has noted, that merger of standards and bureaucracies would create a larger common market for tariff-free import of African manufactured goods. That would constitute a significant incentive to locate factories in Africa, boosting employment, and giving Africans a new channel to help themselves. Almost halfway around the world, a country very different from China is also emerging as a model on gender issues. Rwanda is an impoverished, landlocked, patriarchal society that still lives in the shadow of the 1994 genocide, in which 800,000 people were slaughtered in 100 days. Most of the killers were from the Hutu tribe, and most of the victims from the minority Tutsi tribe, and tribal tensions remain a challenge to the country's stability. Yet somehow from this infertile, chauvinistic soil has emerged a country in which women now play an important economic, political, and social role, in a way that hugely benefits Rwanda as a whole. Rwanda is consciously implementing policies that empower and promote women. And perhaps, partly as a result, it is one of the fastest-growing economies in Africa. In some respects, in everything but size, Rwanda is now the China of Africa. In the aftermath of the genocide, 70% of Rwanda's population was female, and so the country was obliged to utilize women. But it was more than necessity. Men had discredited themselves during the genocide. Women were just minor players in the slaughter, so that only 2.3% of those jailed for the killings were female. As a result, there was a broad sense afterward that females were more responsible and less inclined to savagery. The country was thus mentally prepared to give women a larger role. Paul Kagame, the rebel leader who defeated the genocidaires and became Rwanda's president, wanted to revive his country's economy and saw that he needed women to do that. "You shut that population out of economic activity at your peril," he told us, as his press secretary, a woman, looked on approvingly. "The decision to involve women, we did not leave it to chance," he added. "In the Constitution, we said that women have to make up 30% of the parliament." Kagame speaks fluent English, meets regularly with Americans, and perhaps realized that it would be helpful to brand Rwanda as an equal opportunity country. Rwanda's cabinet room, which is more high-tech than its equivalent in the White House, frequently echoes with women's voices. Kagame regularly has appointed strong women to cabinet posts and other top positions. Women now hold the positions of President of the Supreme Court, Minister of Education, Mayor of Kigali, and Director of Rwanda Television, while at the grassroots level, many women played major roles in village reconstruction. By 2007, Rwanda surpassed Sweden to become the nation with the highest share of women members of any parliament in the world, 48.8% of its seats in the lower house. Then, in September 2008, a new election left Rwanda the first country with a majority of female legislators, 55% in the lower house. In contrast, 17% of members of the United States House of Representatives were women in 2008, leaving the United States ranked 68th among countries of the world in the share of women holding national political office. Rwanda is one of a number of poor countries, others include Costa Rica and Mozambique, that have at least one-third female total representation in parliament. Rwanda is also one of the least corrupt, fastest-growing, and best-governed countries in Africa. Countries like Rwanda and China have shown that governments can nurture women and girls in ways that boost economic development. In such countries with good governance and equal opportunities, Western help is often particularly effective. Mervaline Clark was a 41-year-old woman in Brooklyn who felt a vague desire to be more civic-minded and to devote more of her income to charity. She was earning $52,000 a year working at a bank and thought she had plenty to meet her own needs. "I heard about tithing, where you give 10% of your income to the church," Mervaline explained. "I'm not a member of a church, but I thought I too should give 10% of my income to charity." One priority for Mervaline was a charity that spent little on administrative expenses. So she went online and spent several hours browsing the charities that received the top rating, 4 stars, from Charity Navigator, a website that evaluates charities on their efficiency. Charity Navigator is not a perfect guide, because its focus is on overhead rather than impact, but it's a useful starting point. Mervaline came across an organization called Women for Women International, and she liked what she saw. It's a sponsorship organization that enables an American to support a particular woman in a needy country abroad. Mervaline, a Black woman of Jamaican ancestry, liked the idea of sponsoring an African woman. So she signed up, agreeing to pay $27 a month for a year and asked to be connected to a woman in Rwanda. Mervaline was paired with Claudine Mukakarisa, a 27-year-old genocide survivor from Butar, Rwanda. Extremist Hutus had targeted her family, which was Tutsi, and she was the only survivor. Claudine had been kidnapped at the age of 13, along with her older sister, and had been taken to a Hutu rape house. They started sexually violating both of us, Claudine explained in a shy, pained monotone when we talked with her. And then they started beating us. Large numbers of militia members came to the house, patiently lining up to rape the women. This went on for days, and of course there was no medical attention. We had started rotting in our reproductive organs, and maggots were coming out of our bodies, Claudine said. Walking was almost impossible, so we crawled on our knees. When Kagame's army defeated the genocidaires, the Hutu militia fled to Congo, but took Claudine and her sister along as well. Militia members killed her sister, but finally let Claudine go. I don't know why I was released and my sister killed, she said, shrugging. Probably it was because she was pregnant. Claudine was puzzled by her swelling belly, as she still had no idea about the facts of life. I had thought I could not get pregnant, because I had been told that a girl becomes pregnant only if she is kissed on the cheek. And I had never been kissed. Still only 13 years old and very pregnant, Claudine trekked around the country trying to find help. She gave birth by herself in a parking lot. Unable to see how she would ever feed the baby and hating its unknown father for having raped her, Claudine abandoned it to die. But my heart wouldn't allow me to do that, she said. So I went back and picked up my baby. Claudine begged for food in the streets, and she and the baby barely survived. Many people would chase me away, she said, because I was stinking. Claudine is quiet, demure, soft-spoken. Her lips quiver occasionally as she tells her story in flat tones, but she is not obviously emotional. Her overriding characteristic is the determination to survive with her child. After several years of this, an uncle took Claudine in, but he demanded sex from her in exchange for shelter. When she became pregnant again, he kicked her out. Over time, Claudine found that she could get jobs gardening or washing clothes, typically earning about $1 for a day's work. She managed to send her two children to school, but only barely. The fees were $7 per child per term, and so she and her children lived from day to day. Mervaline's sponsorship gave new hope to Claudine and her children. Of Mervaline's $27 monthly payment, $12 goes to training programs and other support efforts, and $15 is given directly to Claudine. The managers coach the women to save, partly to build a habit of micro-savings, and partly to have a cushion when they graduate from the program in a year's time. And so Claudine saves $5 each month and spends $10. Some of the $10 goes to paying for her children's school fees and buying food. But Claudine devotes some to buying a large bag of charcoal, used for cooking. She sells it bit by bit at a retail markup to other poor families. In addition, Claudine goes to the Women for Women compound each morning for classes. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays are devoted to vocational training, to teach the women skills that will bring them an income for the rest of their lives. Claudine is learning beadwork so that she can make embroidery to sell either on her own or through Women for Women. The aim is for the embroidery to be sold in posh New York department stores. Other women learn how to use reeds to weave baskets or placemats, or if they are really talented, they study sewing so that they can work as tailors. A tailor can earn $4 a day, a respectable income in Rwanda. Those with other skills earn somewhat less. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, the women attend classes on health, literacy, or human rights. One aim is to make the women more assertive and less accepting of injustices. Claudine and Mervaline write each other letters, and Mervaline sent Claudine pictures of New York City to show her where she lived. Claudine and her children studied these pictures with fascination, as if they were viewing another planet. 9 months after sponsoring Claudine, Mervaline was laid off. She laughed when we asked her if she had second thoughts about her sponsorship commitment to Claudine. I never regretted it for a moment, she said. If I'm lucky enough to be able to help her, and she can lift herself out of the position she's in and lift up her family members or other people around her, to me, that's really important. And for me, it was a way to get out of myself. A lot of times, you forget how fortunate you are here, never really needing anything. Since being laid off, Mervaline has had freelance jobs, and she continues to allocate 10% of her income to charity. Any freelance money I get, or if somebody gives me a gift, I keep a running total in my head and think, okay, I've got to give so much. It's not so hard. Claudine is also thriving, and she feels immense gratitude toward Mervaline for giving her and her children this opportunity. It helps that the Rwandan economy is booming, creating more opportunities for Women for Women graduates. But Rwanda is flourishing precisely because it has figured out how to turn people like Claudine into economic assets. Tears over Time magazine. Zainab Salbi is thin, with olive skin and close-cropped black hair framing large, luminous eyes. She looks like Central Casting's idea of a free-spirited Middle Eastern princess, and she speaks English with a tinge of a foreign accent reflecting her childhood in Iraq. Zainab grew up in Baghdad in the period shaped by the long Iran-Iraq War, always fearful of attacks, raised by a father who was a pilot, and a mother who was an unusually emancipated woman trained in biology. But the crucial factor for Zainab's family was that both parents were close to Saddam Hussein. Her father was Saddam's personal pilot, and Zainab grew up calling Saddam uncle and spending weekends at his house, playing with his children. That meant privileges and gifts, including a new car from Saddam each year, but also constant gnawing fear. Proximity did not equal protection, and any slip could mean disaster for the entire family. One of Zainab's friends at school was the daughter of a senior official who was dragged out of a meeting on television and then executed. The daughter became a pariah. Zainab heard whispered stories of Saddam and his sons raping girls, and of intelligence agents videotaping women as they were being raped and then blackmailing the victims afterward. He was a poison gas, Zainab told Cheryl in a long conversation in Zainab's office in Washington, D.C. We breathed him slowly, sometimes dying slowly. Yet Saddam was always courtly and helpful to Zainab, even squiring her around and giving her tours of his property. One time, when she didn't have a bathing suit and everyone else was swimming, he offered her his dishdasha, or robe, to wear so she could join in the fun. She demurred, thinking it might be too transparent when wet. He insisted. She kept refusing. Then, when Zainab was a university student, her mother abruptly and bizarrely pushed Zainab into a marriage with an Iraqi man living in America. All of a sudden, when I'm age 20, my mother begs me to accept a marriage proposal from the United States, Zainab recalled. She begged and cried and said, please listen to me. I wanted to be a good daughter, and so I came to the United States. Zainab barely knew her husband, who was much older, and who soon proved abusive and distant. After 3 months of marriage, he became violent, threw her face down on the bed, and raped her. That's when Zainab walked out on him. The first Gulf War had erupted in the meantime, however, so she couldn't go home. Instead, Zainab remained in the United States, bitterly resenting her mother for having pushed her into a failed marriage and terrified that the American authorities would figure out how close her family was to Saddam. I decided that I would never tell anyone I knew Saddam Hussein, she said, and she kept her secret. Slowly, life improved. Zainab met and married a gentle Palestinian doctoral student named Amjad. They planned a delayed honeymoon in Spain and saved up for it. Iraq receded from her life. Then, in 1993, when Zainab was 24 and had been married to Amjad for 6 months, they were visiting a friend. While Amjad and the friend were in the kitchen preparing dinner, Zainab idly picked up a Time magazine and read an article about rape camps in Bosnia. Serbian soldiers were gang-raping women as part of a military strategy to terrorize the population. The article was accompanied by a photo of some of the women, and it struck such a chord inside Zainab that she burst into tears. Amjad came running in, alarmed. Zainab shoved the article in his face. "We have to do something," she said. "I have to do something to help these women." Zainab called around to humanitarian organizations to see if she could volunteer to help women in Bosnia, but she couldn't find a single group working with the rape victims. She started telephoning around again, offering to set up a program. A Unitarian church agreed to hear her proposal. She walked into the church's board meeting with her father-in-law's briefcase, thinking it would make her look older. With the support of the church, Zainab and Amjad turned their basement into the operations center for a new group that they called Women for Women in Bosnia. They frantically began networking and fundraising, donating the money they had set aside for a delayed honeymoon to Spain. The women in Bosnia needed it more. Soon, Zainab flew to the Balkans and began meeting women who had been raped by Serb soldiers. Her first meeting was with a woman named Ajsa, who had been released from a rape camp when she was 8 months pregnant, too late to get an abortion. For 3 years, Zainab and Amjad struggled to build their organization while taking university courses. Every dime they raised went to the 400 women in their organization, leaving them barely anything to pay bills or to feed themselves. Zainab was just about to give up and look for a paying job when a check for $67,000 arrived in the mail. Working Assets, a phone company that donates 1% of its sales to charity, had chosen Zainab to receive the gift, and it rescued the organization. Over time, the group evolved into Women for Women International, working with survivors not only in Bosnia, but in war-torn countries all over the world. Zainab's next break came in 2000, when Oprah Winfrey put her on her show for the first of 7 interviews. Women for Women International began to thrive, building up a major international network of supporters and a $20 million budget. But Zainab still kept secret her association with Saddam. One day, in the spring of 2004, Zainab was in Bukavu in eastern Congo. She was talking to a woman named Nabito, who described how rebels had raped her and her 3 daughters, the youngest of them just 9 years old. The rebels even ordered one of Nabito's teenage sons to rape her. When he didn't, they shot him in the feet. She told all of this to Zainab and then said, "I never told anybody but you this story." Zainab was horrified. "What should I do?" she asked. "Should I keep it a secret or tell the whole world?" "If you can tell the whole world and prevent it from happening again, then do so," Nabito said. Later that day, on the drive back to Rwanda, Zainab cried. She wept all 5 hours as her driver navigated the bumpy, dirty roads. She cried again back at her room in the guest house. That night, in her room, she resolved that if Nabito could tell embarrassing secrets, then so could she. Zainab decided to reveal her own rape by her former husband, her family's relationship with Saddam, and another secret she had absorbed only recently. Zainab's mother, in failing health, had come to America for a checkup, and Zainab had finally dared talk about the anger she had nursed since her first marriage. Zainab spoke of how betrayed she had felt when her supposedly liberated mother rushed her into an ultimately abusive marriage with an older man she barely knew. Why, she asked her mother, had she urged that marriage? Zainab's mother had lost her voice by then and could communicate only by writing notes. Through tears, she scribbled her response. "He wanted you, Zainab. I didn't see any other way." The "he" was Saddam Hussein. He had lusted after Zainab, and her parents had been terrified that Saddam would seize Zainab and keep her as a mistress until he found a new toy. So, inspired by Nabito, Zainab began telling her full story, every seedy part of it. The irony was that I run a program that encourages women to communicate, but I didn't communicate for a long time, Zainab said. Now I do. Women for Women International is effective because it touches people at the grassroots level. This kind of bottom-up approach in development work has repeatedly shown its superiority in bringing about economic and social change. Meanwhile, far away in West Africa, someone else was using a similar grassroots approach to defeat one of the most ghastly and deeply embedded traditions that harms girls, genital cutting. Chapter 13. Grassroots versus Treetops. Are women human yet? If women were human, would we be a cash crop shipped from Thailand in containers into New York's brothels? Would our genitals be sliced out to cleanse us? When will women be human? When? Catherine A. MacKinnon, Are Women Human? Approximately once every 10 seconds, a girl somewhere in the world is pinned down. Her legs are pulled apart. And a local woman with no medical training pulls out a knife or razor blade and slices off some or all of the girl's genitals. In most cases, there is no anesthetic. Well-meaning Westerners and Africans alike have worked for decades to end this practice. Yet a growing number of mothers were still arranging for their daughters to be cut. Now, finally, in just the last few years, groups of grassroots activists have cracked the code. Led by an Illinois woman who has lived more than half her life in Senegal, these activists seem to have figured out how cutting can be ended, and their movement is snowballing. Incredibly, it looks as if they will make female genital cutting in West Africa go the way of foot binding in China. That makes the campaign against genital cutting a model for a larger global movement for women in the developing world. If we want to move beyond slogans, we would do well to learn the lessons of the long struggle against genital cutting. Today, female genital cutting is practiced mostly by Muslims in Africa, although it is also found in many Christian families in Africa. It is not found in most Arab or Islamic cultures outside Africa. The custom goes back to ancient times, and some female mummies in ancient Egypt have cut genitals. Soranos of Ephesus, a Greek physician who wrote a pioneering book on gynecology in the 2nd century, stipulated, "A large clitoris is a symptom of turpitude. In fact, such women strive to have their own flesh stimulated just like men, and to obtain sexual intercourse, as it were. Now, you will perform the surgical operation on her in the following way. Placing her lying on her back with the feet closed, one should hold in place in a small forceps that which protrudes and appears to be larger, and cut it back with a scalpel." A German textbook on surgery from 1666 includes illustrations on how to amputate the clitoris, and the practice occurred regularly in England until the 1860s, even occasionally after that in Europe and America. Across a broad swath of northern Africa, the practice is still nearly universal. Worldwide, some 130 million women have been cut, and after new research, the UN now estimates that 3 million girls are cut annually in Africa alone. The previous estimate had been 2 million globally. The custom occurs on a smaller scale in Yemen, Oman, Indonesia, and Malaysia, among some Bedouin Arabs in Saudi Arabia and Israel, and among Bora Muslims in India and Pakistan. The practice varies greatly. In Yemen, girls are typically cut within 2 weeks of birth, while in Egypt, it can occur in the early teenage years. The aim is to minimize a woman's sexual pleasure and hence make her less likely to be promiscuous. The most common form of cutting involves snipping the clitoris or clitoral hood, sometimes leaving the clitoris intact and more exposed, an incompetent approach that increases opportunities for orgasm. In Malaysia, the ritual sometimes involves no more than a pinprick, or simply the waving of a razor blade near the genitals. But in Sudan, Ethiopia, and Somalia, it is common to see the most extreme kind, in which the entire genital area is cleaned up by snipping away the clitoris, labia, and all external genitalia. This creates a large, raw wound, and the vaginal opening is then typically sewn up with a wild thistle, leaving a small opening for menstrual blood, with the legs tied together so that the wound can heal. This is called infibulation, and when the woman is married, her husband or a midwife uses a knife to reopen the sealed part so that she can have intercourse. Edna Edan, the midwife in Somaliland who runs her own maternity hospital, has been surveying all the women who have come to deliver over the years. 97% of them were cut, and virtually all of them were infibulated. Edna showed us a video she took of an 8-year-old girl undergoing infibulation. It is excruciating to watch. Traditional birth attendants do the genital cutting in some countries, while in Senegal and Mali, it is often a woman who belongs to the blacksmith caste. Cutters mostly have learned the technique from their mothers or grandmothers, and often they don't use clean blades or can't stop the bleeding. Some girls die or suffer lifelong injuries, but there is no data. A girl who dies after being cut is usually said to have succumbed to malaria. A World Health Organization study found that cutting leads to scar tissue that makes childbirth more dangerous, particularly with the more extreme forms of cutting. Beginning in the late 1970s, there was a Western-led campaign against cutting. Previously, the practice had been referred to as female circumcision, but that was considered euphemistic, so critics branded it female genital mutilation, or FGM. The United Nations took up that terminology, and international conferences were convened to denounce FGM. Laws against FGM were passed in 15 African countries. Articles were written, meetings were held, and not much changed on the ground. Guinea passed a law in the 1960s that punishes female genital cutting with a life sentence at hard labor, or if the girl dies within 40 days of being cut, a death sentence. Yet no case has ever come to trial, and 99% of Guinean women have been cut. In Sudan, the British first passed a law against infibulation in 1925, and extended that to all cutting in 1946. Today, more than 90% of Sudanese girls are cut. "This is our culture," a Sudanese midwife declared angrily when we asked about cutting. "We all want it. Why is it America's business?" The midwife said that she regularly cut girls at the request of their mothers, and that the girls themselves later thanked her. And that's probably true. Mahabuba, the Ethiopian fistula patient who battled hyenas and crawled to a missionary for help, remembers how much she looked forward to her own cutting as a rite of passage. Edna Edan deplores the cutting and says that international campaigns are ineffective, never reaching ordinary Somali women. As we were driving through the Somaliland capital of Hargeisa, she pointed suddenly to a banner across the road that denounced cutting. "So the UN comes and puts up banners in the capital," she said. "What does that do?" "It doesn't make a bit of difference. The women can't even read the signs." Indeed, the international denunciations of FGM prompted a defensive backlash in some countries, leading tribal groups to rally around cutting as a tradition under attack by outsiders. Opponents eventually became smarter and backed off a bit, often using the more neutral term female genital cutting, or FGC. At least that didn't imply that the women they were reaching out to were mutilated, which made it awkward to continue the conversation. More important, leadership passed to African women like Edna, for they can speak with far more authority and persuasiveness than foreigners. Perhaps the most successful effort to end cutting is that of Tostan, a West African group that takes a very respectful approach and places FGC within a larger framework of community development. Rather than lecturing the women, the program's representatives encourage villagers to discuss the human rights and health issues related to cutting and then make their own choices. The program's soft sell has worked far better than the hard sell. Tostan was founded by Molly Melching, a hardy woman from Danville, Illinois, who still looks and sounds like the solid Midwesterner she is. Molly's high school French class led to a fascination with all things French. She studied in France and worked in a slum largely inhabited by North Africans outside Paris. Eventually, she traveled to Senegal in 1974 on a scholarly exchange program that was supposed to last 6 months. Molly is still there. A born linguist, Molly began to learn a Senegalese local language, Wolof, and then signed up for the Peace Corps in Senegal. Molly ran a radio program in Wolof and eventually, from 1982 to 1985, found herself living in a village working on education and empowerment efforts with a small grant from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Not one person in the village had been to school, Molly recalled. There was no school. This was a village of wonderful people who were as smart as could be, but had just never been to school, and who very much needed information.